Thank you, Rabbi Hochberg, and thank you all for coming. Thank you to all the sponsors, particularly to John Kramer for making all the arrangements. I feel like so loud. Is this right?
No,
this is great. Now, before getting anywhere, Rabbi Hochberg, do you want this to be until 8:30 as originally called, or 60 minutes from now?
Whatever works for you.
It's always timing is a very important thing, and you never want people to leave a minute earlier than they signed up for, but not a minute later either. Okay, so we'll see how it goes, but I won't end after 60 minutes. I'm happy to do it. All right, now, the happy part is I'm so glad to be back. I really enjoy learning with Young Israel of Jamaica States very much. Thank you for coming out, as always. People are busy, I've discovered, and it's always good when people have a thirst for Torah to come together, and I find it always very inspiring. On a sad note, I'll just share, my grandmother passed away this past week. The Shiva ends tomorrow. She was, Baruch Hashem, she lived a very full life. I'm blessed to have had all four grandparents and to have known them very well. And she got to know 10 great-grandchildren, which is a real bracha of the first magnitude. One thing that's nice about my family traditions is that we name after the living also. So she had Alzheimer's. But long before she had Alzheimer's, she realized, before she had great-grandchildren, you know, her Yiddish name was Dusha, and she decided it might be wise to pick up a Hebrew name in case grandchildren would want a name after her. So she came to the name Dahlia. And 4 years ago, when my wife and I had twin girls, it was a no-brainer that one of them was going to be Dahlia. And I remember going to my grandma with baby Dahlia, baby Aviva was the other girl in play, and I said as loud as I could, as clearly and as unambiguously, as many different ways as I could, this little baby over here is named after you. And I think she sort of might have gotten it, I'll never know, if she fully internalized that there was a baby walking around with her name, but it's a real bracha to be able to continue to live her memory through our children. So this shiur, like all the shiurim that I've given during the Shiva, this will be the last shiur that I give before the Shiva ends tomorrow morning, is in her memory also. Dusha Dahlia Eshet Harav Pinchas Yechezkel. Megillat Rut, getting back to good things. Don't you feel great reading Megillat Rut? I do. It's so nice, right? How many biblical books can you just open up and read cover to cover and feel, this is great? You know, there are a couple of sufferings along the way. It's not that everything is so joyous and happy, but everybody's so nice and people do such wonderful things for one another. I love that. Megillat Esther, okay, there's Haman, there's Ahasuerus, there are people that you really hate, right? Here, they're lovable. In fact, one nice way of putting the story is that there are no bad guys, right? Megillat Rut is unusual in Tanakh in having normal, regular people who just do what normal, average, regular people might do, like Orpah. She's not bad to decide to listen to her mother-in-law and stay in Moab to find a shidduch. She's probably right. That's what a regular person would do. Or that Ploni Almoni guy, whoever he is, we'll never know because he's just an average Joe Schmo, right? But he chose not to marry a Moabite and complicate his family dynamic and all the laws of inheritance that would affect him. That's what regular people would do. So you have the normal folk, and then you have the supernaturally incredible folk, like Naomi and Boaz and Ruth, who are spectacular. So the regular people are the foils for the super ones. Right? There's something very nice about that, because usually it's really rotten people who are being the foils for the really excellent ones, and you're happy enough just to have some excellent ones. It's a whole other ball game. Source number one is the one that everybody somehow feels religiously obligated to quote, so how am I going to avoid it? I'm going to read them in English, but you have the Hebrew in front of you, so feel free to read it along in the original. Rabbi Zeira said, "This scroll of Rut teaches us nothing, either of cleanliness or of uncleanliness, either of prohibition or permission." It's not a halachic treatise, although there are halachot that are here that really, on the surface, matter a lot. But it's certainly not a halachic treatise. For what purpose, then, was it written? To teach how great is the reward of those who do deeds of kindness. Oh, it's all about chesed. Gomlei chasadim. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. So from the Department of Perspectives, these are just overview points, and then we're going to start the text. But from the Department of Perspectives, why is Megillat Rut part of Tanakh? It's a wonderful story. I feel good. I'm very happy it's part of Tanakh, honestly. I'm sure you are too. But why is it here? Why is it eternally major? So why is it here?
Malchus.
Huh? Oh, so you could argue malchut, meaning what's the most important word of the book according to whoever just said that? The very last word of the book is David. right? Meaning, as a result of all these things, Boaz and Ruth get married, have baby. They don't even have a chance to live happily ever after because it's just done, right? But let's assume for a moment that they lived happily ever after. They have this baby who's Obed, who's the father of Ishai, who's the father of David. And David is the last word. According to Ibn Ezra and Abarbanel, that last word made this book Bible-worthy, right? Meaning everything else is lovely, it's wonderful, you feel good, but it wouldn't necessarily have become part of Tanakh if they're just a bunch of nice people doing nice things. What matters is that these nice people doing nice things are the great-grandparents of David HaMelech. Okay, so according to Ibn Ezra and Abarbanel, David is actually the most important word in the book. Rav Yosef Kara, who's not Rav Yosef Karo, a lot of people confuse that, even sometimes English Bible commentaries make this mistake. Rav Yosef Karo, with the O, is the person who wrote the Beit Yosef and the Shulchan Aruch. He was born in Spain in 1488, was expelled with his family, went to Izmir, Turkey, and eventually made it over to Tzfat and goes down in history. Certainly in the last 1,000 years, is one of the most important halachists, and he's a good Kabbalist to boot, but he's famed as a great halachist. Rav Yosef Kara was a younger student, colleague of Rashi. He was in 12th century France. He's in Mikraot Gedolot. You know, he's the person who's Mahari Kara. Nobody really knows who that is. That's who it is. So it's Rav Yosef Kara. He argues, no, the whole point of the book is that acts of chesed, like the ones that you're going to read, that's what leads to a David. Right? So from that point of view, the whole book matters. It's not just David is the key. It's that, no, the chesed is the key. And that seems to be closer to why this Sefer is here. The Sefer is 85 psukim, you have 5 kind of introductory psukim, which is all we're going to end up doing tonight, even though I only have 3 weeks. It's all about pacing. And then there's 5 psukim at the end, which are, once the story's over, here's the Yehudah genealogy getting you to David. And then there's the 75 psukim in the middle. That's where it all happens. Okay, so that's the whole thing. But it seems that Rav Yosef Kara is correct, that we're dealing with the value of chesed, which is exactly what Rabbi Zeira said as well. Okay, so on that happy note, let's begin the book. We have all kinds of things we're going to have to talk about in a short amount of time. You all have this, by the way. A couple of quick notes, just in general. One, we're in page 1269 in these Art Scroll Chumashim. Another thing, just in general, for those of us who are busy people, I've met some, you can come tonight. You should come to all 3, of course. First of all, you will learn more. And second of all, yes, there is some interrelatedness between the 3 parts because we're all learning the same Megillah. But hopefully, if you miss one, don't feel, oh no, I can't come back in week 3 because I will be lost. You will be lost, but you'll still be able to gain. You'll be able to gain something, and don't think that you will be completely out. It's not quite like the last 3 part series where we have 3 different Sfarim in play, where obviously it was much easier kind of to plug in. Here, hopefully, each one will be able to contribute something, but yeah, it certainly helps to be part of all 3. Vahibi Meshavot HaShafatim, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. Back in the days of the judges, sometime in this centuries-long period that we normally think of as a biblical dark age, Sefer Shafatim is depressing, right? As happy as Megillat Rut is, Sefer Shafatim is a disaster. Just intermarriage and idolatry, and then here come the enemies, and then here comes some Shofet to save the day. Brief respite, and then bam, here we go again. It's just, that's the first 16 chapters, and then the last 5 chapters are even more depressing, right? You have these 2 stories of some random graven image shrine, and then some Pilegesh B'Gibah, which is horrible. It's like just the most depressing story in all of Tanakh. I get ill even mentioning it now like this in passing, where we're not really going to talk about it. And then you have Megillat Rut, this beacon of light from the period, which of course makes its own book over here. Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. Vayhi b'mei Shavuot HaShofetim, vayhi ra'av ba'aretz, vayelech ish mibet lechem Yehuda lagur b'shtei Moav, uvishto shnei banav. Once upon a time, sometime in this period of Shofetim, it doesn't tell you when. Here's what can we tell? How do we know when this story occurred within the period of Shofetim, which took many, many generations? That's right. This is 3 generations before David. So that's around the time of Yiftach, give or take. That's how you can figure these things out from the level of Shah. We can ascertain. We know when that these people are the great-grandparents of David. So there was a famine. And there was a man from Beit Lechem Yehuda who went to Moab, presumably to get food. He went with his wife and his 2 sons. V'shem Aish Elimelech, v'shem Ishto Naomi, v'shem Shnei Banav, Machlon, Mekilion, Ephratim, Mivet Lechem Yehuda, Vayvos Moab, Vayusham. This man's name was Elimelech. And his wife's name was Naomi, and they had two sons, Mahlon and Kilion, who were Ephratim, presumably from either Ephraim or from Har Ephraim, Beit Lechem Yehudah, or maybe even from Ephrat, more likely given that we're talking about Beit Lechem. Vayvosei Moav ayiyu sham. And they went to Moab, and that's where they were. Okay, so who's the story about? Huh? What's this book going to be about? It's about Elimelech, yeah? I love that. Our author is so full of surprises. And it's worth noting it. First of all, it's a great literary convention that he uses. It's really wonderful. It's also important because this book tends to be more familiar than, say, Divrei HaYamim. Not that Divrei HaYamim should be unfamiliar. But often enough, Megillat Rut is more familiar. Right? So, we know how these things turn out if we've read them year in and year out. And we might have even learned them in depth periodically. But the author of Megillat Rut is really good at setting you up and then just faking you out. Like, this is a good example. Once upon a time, there was a man, and his name was Elimelech. And I'm like, all right, I can't wait to see what's going to happen to him. And then he dies in Pasid Gimel. Right? And then he's done. I guess the story wasn't about him after all. If you want another really good example, at the threshing floor scene in chapter 3, if these are unfamiliar things, definitely feel free to read the four chapters between now and next thing. But I imagine that some people are familiar that there's this funny threshing floor scene where Ruth is lying at Boaz's feet, essentially there to propose, and she does a swell job. And so she basically says, will you marry me? And we're all like, yeah, you go. And then Boaz, you know, I think Boaz isn't going to be the one. And Boaz says, yes, but there's some other guy who's ahead of me in line. He wasn't supposed to say that, right? We all knew that it was going to be Boaz. We still somehow know that it's going to be Boaz. But then he brings up this other guy. All right, fine. So we know that the plot has to get rid of this other guy. So chapter 4 rolls around. Boaz gets everybody together. The town is there. Other guy whose name is, you know, Ploni Almoni shows up. And we all know this guy is never going to go anywhere. So, you want to redeem the field? And he says, yes. And at this point, you realize it's chapter 4, and this book is only 4 chapters long. Something is really wrong here, right? But then Baruch Hashem, the root factor gets introduced. He's out. Boaz and Ruth get married. But this happens a lot in just a very tiny book, where our narrator is doing a spectacular job at making you sure that something is going to happen, and then confusing you just a little bit, and he's full of surprises. So I like that a lot. So back in my rabbiing days, meaning professional rabbi as opposed to full-time education, so I went to a lot of Brit Milahs. I still go to a bunch of Brit Milahs, Baruch Hashem, but certainly it's a slower pace than it was on the rabbiing side. Where baby boys are born all the time, Baruch Hashem. And so all of a sudden there's a lot of mini muffins to be consumed. And what happens during these mini muffin scenes, right, is that everybody's going back for that other croissant or mini muffin or whatever's going up, and then at some point the father gets up ready to make his speech, and I always used to tell the father, you make sure, you can say whatever you want. Your wife is the biggest hero in the world today, you make sure that somehow all the rest of us hear about that, right? It's very important. And so you just imagine Elimelech getting up at the brit, praising Naomi to the sky when their children were born, and you know, everybody's going for that last mini muffin and whatever else is going on. And then he says, and I name my sons, I'm pretending that they're twins, okay? I don't know if they were twins, but why go through this exact scene twice just to make the point? And I name my sons Mahlon and Kilion. And I name them that not because their great-grandfathers were Mahlon and Kilion, but because... What do Mahlon and Kilion mean?
Destruction.
Oh, see, see, if I were his rabbi, I would have said, maybe you want to choose other names, right? What kind of names are these? Sickness and destruction? Are you kidding me? So seriously, we read this every year. What do you do with that?
It's not really their names.
Oh, so you could say that these are literary names, and why would these be their literary names? Because they're dead by Pasuk Hey, right? This is what we would call a Midrash Shemot. Tanakh does that sometimes. It sometimes uses names that are not necessarily the names that mom and dad gave them back in the day, but the names that mom and dad gave them back in the day don't matter eternally. Whereas for us, if these are literary names, the point is that Mahlon and Kilion really means sickness and destruction, and we're supposed to hear that. Just like Ploni Almoni, I'm sure his mom and dad didn't name him Joe Anonymous, but he's called Joe Anonymous by our narrator because he didn't act like Boaz, right? He is just what a regular guy would do. Okay, so he fades from history. Boaz, his name is immortal because he's Boaz after all. Right? One example in the Chumash, Ralbag says this about why Hevel was named Hevel. Right? All the way, right? Why was he named Hevel according to Ralbag? Because he also dies pretty quick and he vanishes from the world. So Ralbag says that that is a literary name. The Torah doesn't say why Chava named Hevel Hevel. Perhaps she didn't name him Hevel. And so already in the Chumash, you have the possibility of literary names, Midrash Shemot. Another thing that's worth noting, though, is that the name Machlon, there's nobody else in Tanakh named Machlon, but some of you know Benot Salavcha's names offhand. And one of them is Machla, and there are other people with names like this also. And so all these people were sick, maybe, but probably what is the shoresh of all of these names, Machlon included? It's like Michila, it's like forgiveness, it's a beautiful name. Right? It could well be that even though we hear sickness and destruction because we can't help ourselves because they're dead in Pasuk Hey, it could be that Elimelech really got up at that speech and named his kid Machlon because may God forgive us because he was a righteous man. And Kilion, even though it could mean destruction, it also could mean completion. Right? Could very well be that these are perfectly wonderful, beautiful names. There's nothing negative about them. So our possibilities, just to round them up, one, these were their real birth names. A, and they're perfectly nice names, but there are midrashim that still darshan them because they're still dead in Pasuk Hey. Or it could be that these are literary names based on the fact that they are dead in Pasuk Hey. So those are the options when you deal with stuff like this. Regardless, they're dead in Pasuk Hey, which means that we have to make Elimelech dead first. So poor, it's a tough tape for the menfolk. In the meantime, Pasuk Gimel, Vayamot Elimelech Ish Naomi. So Elimelech dies, but Hishayar hi Ushne Baneha. Now Naomi remains behind with her two sons. Vayisu lahem nashim Moaviyot. Shema achad Orpa, v'shema sheni Rut, v'yeshivu sham ke'eser shanim. So these two men, Machlon and Kilion, marry Rut and Orpa, or Orpa and Rut. It doesn't tell us here who married whom. And it's only in Perek Daleth that you finally learn that Rut is the one who married Machlon. Okay, so that's just you don't know that from here, but regardless, and they're there for 10 years. Vayamutu gam shnei Machlon veKilion vatishayer haisha mishnei yiladeh umeisha. And now Machlon and Kilion die, also leaving the three women behind, namely Naomi and her two daughters-in-law, Rut and Orpah. So let me ask you: these five psukim set up the story. Now we have three widows, and this is where everything happens, right? Are these five psukim just background? In other words, we need to make the men dead because the story is about how these widows come to terms with all of that? Or did Elimelech and Machlon and Kilion do something bad, and therefore they're being smitten by God for something sinful?
Yes.
What about, I gave two options. That was a good hedge.
Yes.
They abandoned Klal Yisrael. They were smitten by God because they did something bad.
Okay.
They left.
Okay. So they left. We have one vote for they sinned by leaving. Okay, and what's wrong with leaving?
They were prominent in the community and there was bad things going on. There was famine and they shouldn't have left. They should have stayed to strengthen the community, to not abandon ship.
Okay, so they abandoned ship. Good. What else?
Well, Elimelech didn't, but they intermarried.
So we have intermarriage also, right? That they married the sons. You're right, not Elimelech. Good caveat there. But Machlon and Kilion married Moabites, yeah?
They didn't take the kids, so Elimelech
died. They stayed another 10 years. Oh. Playing off of that and taking it one step further, that Elimelech died, that should have been a warning signal to everybody. And nobody took much warning because they just hung around for another 10 years, got married altogether, built roots in Moab, and that made it worse for them, so they died too. Okay. Yeah?
Well, I sort of disagree in regard to Elimelech because when it says Elimelech, he went Lagur. Lagur is like visiting. But when it comes to the children later on, it says Vayeshu, which means like living there. Maybe there is a possibility that it is that Elimelech maybe just happened to die and it was a warning message to the children. They ignored it. They decided to go over and say, hey, we're going to marry people and neighbors who are not Jewish and we're going to stay here forever. And that's when they happened to die.
So you're saying that Elimelech didn't necessarily do anything bad, but Machlon and Kilion, by remaining, you know, you're playing off of that, but just leaving Elimelech a little more off the hook. Okay.
And the intermarriage thing is not clear, because there wouldn't have been Yivam had they not converted.
Right, so you're jumping ahead to what Naomi tells her daughters-in-law, and you may be right. The thing is, we're not sure if she means that literally or if she's being rhetorical. You know, she could just be saying, look, you'll never find a shidduch. And even if I can give you a son, forget about it, you can't even wait for it. Because that's also not a halachic statement, right? If she had a son tomorrow, there's no halacha if you boom on this kid because the kid wasn't alive at the time of the death. Right? So it's not a halachic statement, it's a rhetorical statement. The question is how much you want to read in. But your point is very well taken, yeah?
I mean, there was no set form of conversion at that time anyway.
We're not sure, but... We're not sure what the protocol was for conversion in the biblical period in general. It certainly was much easier for a woman to convert in, whatever it took, besides just not needing to be circumcised. But on a practical level, if a woman, non-Jewish woman, marries Jewish man... Even the word Jewish is somewhat anachronistic, but let's just go for it for now. She lives on his ancestral plot, and their children inherit the land. They immediately become part of the nation. A man never owns land. If a man converts in, right, he's never a landowner.
She marries him.
I'm saying a woman can immediately become integrated into the community in a way that a man always would have to be an outsider in that sense, because he has no ancestral plot. Okay, good. You had your hand up? Okay. So far we're beating all up on Elimelech and Machlon and Kilion, and maybe we should. Maybe they did terrible, terrible things. There are midrashic sources that support what all of you said, so you're in very, very excellent company. We'll look at source number 11 on the bottom of page 2 over here. You'll have to forgive the Sansino translation for using a somewhat anachronistic term for the country here. But in the meantime, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, Elimelech, Machlon, and Kilion were of the great men of their generation, and they were also leaders of their generation. Why then were they punished? Because they left Israel for a foreign country. I paraphrased a little, just based on when the Sansino was written. But in the meantime, that's what you said over here, that they ditched their community. Right, here they were wealthy, they were leaders, and then the going got tough and they packed on out of there and head over to hightail it to Moab. And everybody else is left behind. Okay, so that's where you're coming from. Source number 12. Why then was Elimelech punished? The assumption, of course, is that Elimelech died for his sins. He was one of the notables of his place and one of the leaders of his generation. But when the famine came, he said, now all Israel will come knocking at my door for help, each one with his basket. Translate here as like a pushka, like that kind of basket, right? Except back then you would have put wheat and tomatoes in the basket instead of a coin. But coins weren't invented yet in the time of Megillat Rut. But in the meantime, he therefore arose and fled from them. This is the meaning of the verse, and a certain man of Beit Lechem in Judah went. Okay, also, ditch the community. So you shall feel good. Your background is coming into play here. Source number 13. His son should have learned from their father and returned to Israel. Somebody said they should have taken the hint. Voila. Right? Instead, they married Moabite women who hadn't immersed and hadn't converted. Since they did not realize that they should repent, they immediately died. They didn't take the hint. Not exactly what you said. And that... So we understand Elimelech is guilty of ditching community. Machlon and Kilion are guilty of intermarriage, remaining behind, all these terrible things. Okay.
They were there 10 years.
Yeah, now see, yeah, and just to be difficult about this. Now wait a minute. How do you know that these were wealthy people who ditched the community? I read the same sources you just read. But in Megillat Rut, when you're reading that, is that the impression that you get at all? People... And by the way, what happened when there was a famine in Avraham Avinu's time? The master, the Avi HaMaminim, as Rambam names him. What does he do? He goes to Egypt. Why did he go to Egypt? There's more food there than there was here. Right? In other words, he understood that he went there. So Ramban is critical of Avraham Avinu, but everybody else thinks that he did what any normal human being would do. If God doesn't give you explicit instructions, stay here despite the famine, I shall sustain you, then of course Avraham Avinu would have stayed. But why in the world should we treat Elimelech with a harsher standard than Avraham Avinu?
Avraham didn't leave his people.
Oh, so you're good counterclaim. So by the way, Radak says what I just said. Radak thinks that Elimelech has done nothing wrong at all by leaving. He's just doing what you do when there's a famine. You go somewhere where there's food so you can take care of your family. So he stops it right there, but no, there's a difference between Abraham and Elimelech. What is very clear is that when Naomi comes back with Ruth, a lot of years later, over 10, right? Everybody else is there, right? They left behind the community that is in the text. It's not that Abraham and Sarah and the whole clan up and went and now there's nobody left behind because they can support themselves. Here the impression that you get is they could have made it in Israel. And they chose to leave. That still doesn't prove that they were wealthy people who were ditching their community, but it shows that there's an important distinction between the two, which Chazal seemed to be very sensitive in the Midrashim that we have over here.
They called him Ish.
Huh? Oh, very good. So the Midrash is playing off of, very good, off the word Ish. It says in Pasuk Aleph, right, Vayelech Ish mi Beit Lechem Yehuda, that a man left. What does Ish mean in Tanakh? It can mean one of two things. It can mean male person, in which case there's no significance to this at all, or it can mean an important person. These Midrashim that we're looking at, obviously, are taking this to mean important person. So why mention his importance? Okay, it's because of exactly what you said. Important person left, important family left, and everybody else is left behind. And that's what the Midrash is very sensitive to, yeah?
But you have that with Moshe's parents too.
Right.
So obviously he's talking about Amram, and they're not identified till later. So if we see in that pasuk, Ganesh is a prominent man. He was the head of his shevet.
Yeah, but not every time in Tanakh does Ish mean prominent. It could just, sometimes it really just means male person.
What does it mean that they lived there 10 years?
What are my options?
They were married for 10 years and yet they didn't have children.
Right.
Or they lived there, then they got married.
Oh, no. It sounds like they're married for 10 years, no children, and we move on now. Meaning they already said they had their...
But that in itself is a problem.
What's the problem?
Because they don't have children, they were married 10 years, and they should have divorced their wife.
Okay, fine. But that, you may be right, you may not be right, but that's beyond our story. I don't know what they were supposed to do, because they're dead by Pasuk Hey. Well, you also have it with Abraham and Sarah. It goes back to Abraham and Sarah. It was 10 years in the land of Israel before... No, it was 10 years in the land of Israel. Because he was 85 years old. It was exactly... that goes back to the original, you know, to the very beginning of it all. But, okay, yeah. Hold on. Yeah?
The names Machlon and Kilion are Midrash. Maybe from perhaps we can assume that Elimelech is a Midrash again. That is signifying some importance to that man. Elimelech is a...
It's a very regal name. Well, Elimelech doesn't mean I'm a king. What does Elimelech mean? It's a very religious name. God, my God is king, right? What's great, as long as you're mentioning this, one of the sources that I skipped for the sake of time, but now you're mentioning it, so it's such a neat little thing. Okay, now I just have to find it, but I know it's here somewhere. Yeah, source number 10. Rabbi Yoshua ben Korcha was wont to interpret names. I mean, he's darshaning names. He doesn't pretend that these are the original meanings of the names. He's darshaning them based on the characters. And the name of the man was Elimelech, since he used to say, "To me shall the kingdom come." He translates it as Eli Tava Malchut. It's antithetical to what the name really means. Yael Ziegler, who just published that Magid Press 506-page book on Megillat Ruth, it's very good, you should read it. So she made, well, I think, one of the best points in the whole book. So at least you'll know one really good point from this book, is she very rightly points out that Chazal here are specifically turning the name on its ear, right? Because Elimelech is this, my God is king. What more righteous name could you get than that? And they turn him into this selfish entitlement scoundrel. Right? Like, yeah, kingdom belongs to me. It's all about me. A lie instead of Eli, my God. It's an amazing transition, and she really plays that up very nicely in her book. So that all being said, so that's what we get from this thing. Let's, yeah, one more comment. Fair enough. If Ste Moav literally means that he became a field owner there, and you may be right, then for sure he's wealthier than a pauper who, you know, is just coming and begging away. It sounds like he's more than just begging. Okay, very good. So another point that somebody else mentioned, by the way, is that if the text is trying to tell you that Machlon and Kilyon died because of intermarriage, they should have died right after the non-chupah. I was about to say chupah, and I realized I shouldn't do that, because the problem is that, you know. But anyway, they should have died immediately. What's with this 10-year gap? Right? If God is trying to tell us and them, don't ever do this kind of thing, well then, the message isn't very clear. If they married for 10 years, that's a long time. It's not, okay, they didn't die. Huh?
Huh? They had no children.
I feel bad for them, but I'm saying, I'm just saying that the death as a result of intermarriage doesn't seem to be what the text is trying to say.
They died after 10 years of being warned.
Being
warned.
But where do you see warnings though? Fine. Again, I feel and your answer may be better than some of the other answers the way that we've read them, because you're actually saying that the barrenness or the non childbearingness of the story is relevant, right? And I think you may be right. I'm just pointing out that it's hard to be sure. I have a very hard time being sure that Elimelech, Machlon, and Kilyon, I mean, they might have died for sins, but I'm not sure if the Megillat Rut is trying to tell you that. Right? It might be ditched community, that's it, that's awful, dead. But it doesn't say that, right? It just says they left because there's a famine and then he's dead. And it might be, ooh, intermarriage, that's terrible, it is terrible. But I'm not sure that Megillat Rut is trying to tell me, oh, they died because they intermarried. And if you're now suddenly doubting it as well, then you realize that we have an interesting situation where what everybody said before still might be right. I don't think it's not there. There's three deaths and five psukim. You really get the sense of God's presence is here, they're doing the wrong thing, maybe it is a punishment. But maybe it's not. Maybe this is just good old background to the story. We need these men to be dead because the plot doesn't happen if they're alive.
It wouldn't be right? Rude.
That's what I'm saying. You wouldn't have Megillat Rut. Our story is predicated on the death of these three men and how the women react to that. Yeah.
But Arpah and Rut are royalty. And if they were plain schleppers that came from Israel, they wouldn't have married royalty.
Right, but you're making two midrashic assumptions here, right? Which may be also right, but they may not be. In other words, the text doesn't talk about Rut and Orpah as princesses. Right? They're just two Moabite women. I know nothing about their background in the text, right? Plus, I don't know if Elimelech really is a prominent family. Might be, probably was. Not clear. So, in the world of midrash, you always have to be... I love the world of midrash. And we're going to get lots and lots of midrash, believe me. But it's important to distinguish what's explicitly there, what you might be able to tease out, and what is purely in the realm of Midrash. What is purely in the realm of Midrash is Rut and Orpah's background as either, depending on the Midrashic source, I'm sure many of you have heard this before, either daughters of or granddaughters of some guy named Eglon. Who is Eglon? He was the king of Moab in Shofetim, Perek Gimel.
He stood up.
Who, well, he was very rotund, right? And Ehud ben Gera, who was the shofet in play, I'm a lefty, so I always used to think of him as like my best hero, because here's this lefty guy who saves the day because he's left-handed, right? He probably wasn't left-handed. It's so depressing. Like, you learn more in life, and you just lose your one lefty. He was a righty like everybody else, because everybody back then was right-handed, of course. But Shevet Binyamin, it's nice that that was the name of the tribe, right? Binyamin, it's all about right-handedness. I don't think, I'm not being funny, I meant that. But anyway, they were the closest we ever had. Shevet Binyamin was the first tribe of Israel to come up with the idea of crack commandos. And the way that they would do that is, iter yad yimino, means they would tie your right hand to your side and force you to, they would train you to fight left-handed, because since everybody in the ancient world was right-handed, so everybody learned to fight the same way. Just right hand holds the sword and left hand has the shield. And now Shevet Binyamin came up with this brilliant idea. Hey, let's create switch hitters. Right? Let's force our guys, or at least some of them, to learn to fight lefty, and the enemy won't know what to do with themselves. Right? It was brilliant. So Ehud Ben-Gera as a lone fighter, you have hundreds more in the Pilagash B'Givah story, by the way, also. But they had more lefties floating around in Shevet Binyamin, which gave them a huge advantage against superior numerical forces of the elder 11 tribes that were fighting against Binyamin. But Ehud is the famous one. Now Ehud kills Eglon with that nice little slick, left-handed move. And he stood up for a message from God, and so we respect him for that. What matters is that that's the only place in Sefer Shofetim where Moab matters, right? And since we're dealing with a Moabite type story, it's nice to link our, that's what Chazal do, right? They link our story here, which is in a nondescript period of Sefer Shofetim, with something to do with the only time we find Moab anywhere in Sefer Shofetim, namely with Eglon. So that's how Rut and Orpah become princesses. And then, as long as the Midrash is really on a roll, and this is great stuff, and hopefully we'll be able to talk about this also, not only did they have an interesting father or grandfather, depending on the Midrashic source, but, well, we know that in Pshat, Ruth's great-grandson was, in fact, David. But Orpah needs an illustrious great-grandchild, because after all, that's what this Midrashic lineup is all about. So who should she become the ancestor of? Goliath, who, keep in mind, is a Philistine. He's from the other side of the town, right? Doesn't matter. And there's a whole Midrashic thing about how there were B'nai HaRafa, which means children of the giant, but suddenly HaRafa and Orpah, there's enough similar letters there. That's how the Midrash comes into play. And before you know it, Orpah becomes the great-grandmother or so of Goliath, right? Which is really cool. I love that. I love these Gemara. They're phenomenal. But before we, but all I'm trying to say to you is that all of that belongs to a whole creative and brilliant endeavor of Chazal, which we're going to talk about as a Chazal thing, but it's not emanating from here. The Megillat Rut in no way casts Rut and Orpah as princesses, and even more than that, even Ezra points out further that the Gemara cannot fully be factually correct within the text. How do we know? Because in Pasuk Tetvav, we're not up to that yet, but if you look at Pasuk Tetvav, when Naomi is going all out to try to dissuade Rut and Orpah from coming with her, she wants them to stay in Moab, and we'll talk about that next time. She says, "Vatomer neshava yivimtech elamav el Eloha." She tells, at this point, Orpah is already gone, and she tells Ruth, "Look, your what's yivimtech? Translate, your sister-in-law, which means that they weren't sisters, right?" So even Ezra, the fact that Naomi talks to Ruth and says, "Your sister-in-law has returned." He says, well, that means that they were not sisters.
Why couldn't they be?
They could be. You surely are correct that they could be. But even Ezra just says, from a plausibility standpoint, Naomi certainly knew if they were sisters or not, and likely would have said, your sister has gone back. The fact that she refers to her as your sister-in-law implies that Naomi, understanding the family dynamic, understood that Ruth and Orpah likely were not biological sisters. They're Midrashic sisters. Which is also very important, just like Orpah is the Midrashic great-grandmother of Goliath, which is also very important. That's very different from saying that that's what the text says. Right? So that.
But there was a Jewish tradition that the two brothers shouldn't marry two sisters.
What are you talking about? I had great uncles and aunts who do that kind of stuff. And they all turned out fine. Thank you. But in the come on, all these small town things, where everybody marries everybody. That happened all the time. In the meantime, as long as it's not Ariot, it's okay. Anyway, getting back to the main issue at hand, you could read this story as God is smiting everybody down, and I think that that's a fair reading. Contemporary literary scholars prefer that reading, by the way. They like the idea of them being smitten down, and they see that as part of a global theme in Megillat Rut of God's hand is behind everything. But I just want to propose the alternative, not to side with it. I'm really genuinely not sure. I like being unsure, but it happens that in Megillat Rut, I'm really unsure. Right? And it might very well be that nobody's being punished for anything over here, and that they're dying. We don't know. It could very well be that they did terrible things, but Megillat Rut is not saying that they did terrible things. Megillat Rut is getting rid of the men folks so that we can get up to our story. And the whole Megillah could be read in these two tracks. For example, at the end, where everybody lived happily ever after, right? Boaz marries Ruth, they have a kid. Now Mia's toast of the town. She is doing great, right? She's got the field back, and she's holding the baby, and all the women folk are like, wow, you lad ben la Naomi, mazal tov, it's like your child. It's Very good, right? Okay, so I'm, and the best part is like where everybody just drops, I'm such a New Yorker, all these Beit Lechemites just drop the chickens and run to the gate, and by the end of the Megillah, like, you know, it starts off with Boaz and a handful of people, and before you know it, the whole town is there. I love that. But in the meantime, the whole town shows up, everybody's hurling blessings at them. Okay, so what's the theological message of that? So I'll give you two, and I'm not sure which is right, or I'm not sure that by the end of this three-week series that we're going to be sure which is right. One is, God is rewarding these wonderful people for doing spectacular things. I'm good with that. Maybe God is rewarding them. Or it could be that the Megillah is teaching that the consequence of people doing supernatural chesed the way that Boaz, Naomi, and Ruth did leads to good results. Right? That it's a consequence of their good behavior, that they took care of each other and they made a better community. Right? And God doesn't necessarily play a role. There's only two psukim where the narrator gives God credit for anything. Explicitly. In the whole Megillah. It's a small Megillah, so maybe it's not as dramatic a statistic. But God could have shown up in more places. It could have said that God brought the famine, for example. But it doesn't. There was a famine. God's not mentioned here. God only shows up in the narrative twice for having for credited to do anything. One is Pasuk Vav, the one that we happen to be up to. So we could just look at that. After these 10 years plus go, Naomi and her daughters-in-law arise and they start to return from Moab to Yehuda because she heard that God had taken note of his nation to give them bread. So God ended the famine. Okay, so that's one place where God is credited with doing something. And the other one is kind of in a funny context. It's in Perek Dalet Pasuk Yud Gimel, where it says that God made Ruth pregnant. Meaning Boaz and Ruth are married. And God gets credit explicitly for helping her get pregnant. Yeah? That's not the narrative. Correct. In the story, God gets a lot of airtime, but that's a character speaking. In other words, Naomi perceives the events, and she may be right. I can't tell you that that's not what happened. But that's the character speaking. I'm saying when the third-person narrative speaks, when the narrator, so to speak, is speaking, those are the only two places where the narrator gives credit to Hashem for doing things, which means, well, are you supposed to extrapolate? Well, Hashem does everything, and so the whole point of the Megillah is Hashem punishes Elimelech, Mahlon, and Kilion at the beginning for sins and rewards Ruth, Boaz, and Naomi at the end for their mitzvot, maybe. Or it could be that these are all consequences. Elimelech, Mahlon, and Kilion die, I don't know why, and the people do good things at the end because they acted. Boaz did the right thing, and that's why he's married to Ruth. And Ruth did the right thing by showing up and proposing in the first place. And Naomi did the right thing by orchestrating the whole thing. She's terrific. And so everybody makes it happen. But I don't know that God is explicitly credited by the Megillah. So when you're interested in what is Pshat, it all goes back to what Rabbi Hochberg said at the beginning. It was a good name for the book. I didn't even think of it myself, but I should have. But in the meantime, it's true. Pshat isn't so simple. It's really true. I'm not sure what the Megillah is trying to say. I see what these midrashic sources say, and they're all reasonable. They're reasonable within the realm of Pshat, but it's not clear that that's what's happening over here.
But even here, he may not be crediting God directly. He's just saying this is what Ruth heard. This is what Naomi heard.
Correct. Even this pasuk is not as good as the other one, where it's more explicit. The other one, really, the narrative speaks God made Ruth pregnant, so to speak. Here, you're right. Naomi heard, and you could say that even that's in the perception of the character. I've had some discussions with people about whether this should even count. But I'm scraping here as a means of showing at least here God gets some credit, as opposed to the rest of the story where that is not clear at all. Okay, good. So this brings us to Pasuk Zion, back in Perek Aleph. So at this point, Naomi leaves the place where she had been, and she's bringing her daughters-in-law, or her daughters-in-law are with her. And they're going back home. I mean, Naomi is going back home, and Ruth and Orpah have never been there before, so they're accompanying her. So Naomi speaks to her two daughters-in-law. You shall all go back home. God should do chesed to you, as you have done to the dead ones, namely to your husbands who are no longer alive, and to me as well. The word chesed, by the way, biblically, doesn't mean what you and I as rabbinic Jews use it as. Chesed to us is acts of loving kindness. This is ben adam l'chaveiro. Right, if you're a Baal Chesed, that means that you're Avraham Avinu with the tent. You're in hospitality, and you're taking care of people. You can be a Baal Tzedakah, you can visit the sick. All kinds of great acts of Chesed can be done. Chesed in Tanakh means primarily loyalty. So Zachart Yilach Chesed Nuraich. God remembers the loyalty of Bnei Israel, that they weren't doing acts of kindness to Hashem. They were faithful to Hashem by following him into the desert, even though there was no promise that there would be any food there when they got there. So chesed has to do with loyalty, and you understand that if you're loyal to a person, you might also visit them when they're sick. Right? In other words, the rabbinic usage of the term chesed, which has become very much ben adam l'chaveiro, interpersonal relationships, emerges from the biblical meaning, but it's not identical. So in the biblical context here, what it's saying here, may God do chesed to you, it's a way of saying, may God show loyalty to you, may God do good things to you, as you have been loyal to your husbands and to me as well. Niten Adonai lachem umtsena minucha, isha bet isha, vatishak lahem vatisena kolan vatifkena. So God should bless you, umtsena minucha, you should find rest. What does rest mean here?
Tranquility.
Here it means a shidduch. Literally it means may you find tranquility, may you find rest, all of those good things. Here it doesn't mean all that stuff. It means very particularly you should find a home. You should get married when you are here. And that's what the whole framework of our story is. Isha beit isha. Each one of you women should find a husband. Vatishak lahen vatisena kolam vatifkena. It's really a wrenching scene, and I give everybody a lot of credit here. Because after all, Naomi is bereft of her husband and her sons. I feel awful for her. My heart is shattered. You know, it's so few psukim, and a lot has happened. Sometimes when you get analytical, you forget the basic human plot, which is she has lost her world, right? Here's a woman who's devastated. And all she has to cling to are these two lovely women, who are very nice. I like them both very much. Okay, I happen to be partial to Ruth for all kinds of reasons. But Orpah is very nice too. Right? Orpah is very sweet. They're both coming. They don't even think of just staying home. They both are loyal. They both have made family ties. They both feel that they're part of the family now. They're coming. Naomi, it seems, stands to gain a lot having them come with her because she needs to be with somebody. And in fact, in practice, Ruth took care of her. So if she had two, so then she'd have two people gleaning. Right? That would be great. It would be much better from a personal welfare point of view for Naomi to bring them back. The fact that she's telling them, you're better off finding a shidduch here, is she's the greatest mother-in-law who ever lived, with the exception of mine. Right? but other than that, she's amazing. This is a very great act of self-sacrifice. And Ruth and Orpah are phenomenal just as well by accompanying Naomi. They realize that they're being lech lecha me'aretz lecha mi'beit avicha and all of those things. They're forfeiting their family setting, their friends, you know, where they shop. All the stuff that they're used to for their whole lives, this is where they're from. To just up and go where they're going to be, what Ruth ended up being, beggars. It's not like they're coming in and they're going to be part of the royalty in Beit Lechem. Right? Ruth is giving it all up. Very limited chance of a shidduch. And have you ever gleaned? I never have. Gleaning is awful. Gleaning, I can't tell you how bad I feel for Ruth, that she's going to have to go out from sunup to sundown following the reapers with the hopes that maybe some stalks will fall to the ground, and then you have to quickly pounce on them before some other beggar gets over there. Right? And this is a 12-hour day, and then if you're lucky, you have enough to feed yourself, and now you're broke again, and now you got to do this tomorrow through the entire harvest season. It's awful. Right, okay, so we know that Boaz took extra good care by having the reapers drop extra stuff. But A, that wasn't expected, and B, it still was a hard job. Right? It's not a job, it's being a beggar. It's very hard to be a gleaner. So Ruth and Orpah, by choosing to go with Naomi, I think it's a phenomenal act of self-sacrifice too. There's a lot of nice people in this page. It's really, there's a lot of good. So here we go. Pasuk Yud. So as they're crying, Vatomarna la, she says to them, they tell her, no, we say Ruth and Orpah, we're coming with you. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vatomer Naomi, Shov na benotai, lamate lachna imi. Why should you go back? Why should you return with me? Ha'od li banim b'me'ai v'hayu lachem anashim. That's what you were referring to before. Do I have any more children in my womb that I can married to you. So this is invoking the Yibum principle, but it's a non-halachic invocation. Right? Meaning, even if she were to give birth tomorrow, the halachot of Yibum don't govern this case, because the brother was not alive at the time of the death of the husbands, of Machlon and Kilion. So it's not real Yibum. But it's a fine rhetorical move. She's saying, basically, the only chance you'd ever have to have a shidduch is my own sons, but I don't have any more. Right? That's what she's telling them. Pasuk Yud Bet, Shov na benotai lechna, chizakanti miyod li'ish. I'm too old to get married again. Ki amarti yesh li tikva, gam hayiti alayla li'ish, v'gam yaladti banim, alahen tisaberna, asher yigdalu. Let's say, hypothetically speaking, I even got married today, had children right away. Would you actually wait until they grew? Alahen te'agena, levilti hayod li'ish. This is the only place in Al Tanakh, by the way, that the Shoresh for Aguna appears. Right? Are you going to be agunot? Are you going to be chained to these little babies and wait for them to grow? Al benotaki marli meod mikem ki atzaa bi yad Adonai. It's a bitter situation. God has smitten me. Vatisena kolam vatipkena od vatishak or palachamota veru davaka ba. This is that dramatic parting moment where Orpa realizes, you know, mom is right, mother-in-law, she's right. She'll never find a shidduch in Israel. She's right. It's a miracle that Ruth did. But in the meantime, Orpah accepts Naomi's point, and as wrenching as it is, she cries, she kisses Naomi, and she stays in Moab, and Ruth clings to her. Pasuk tetvav, Vatomer, Hine shava yivimtech, elama ve'el Eloheha, shuvi achrei yivimtech. Naomi says, okay, one down, one to go. Look, your sister-in-law has returned to her nation and to her gods. You should return, follow her, follow your sister-in-law. Vatomer Rut, al tifki'i bi lo'ozvech lashuv me'acharayich, ki et el asher telechi elech v'asher talini alin amech ami ve'elohayich elohai. Don't tell me to go back. I'm staying with you. Wherever you go, I shall go. Wherever you sleep, I shall sleep. Your nation is my nation. Your God is my God. Basher tamut yamut, b'shamek haver. Wherever you die, I want to be buried next to you. Ko yaseh Adonai li v'kol yasif, ki amavet yafri b'ni v'nech. I swear to God that only death will separate us. It's amazing. Okay. So, if you don't love Ruth already, this should have done it, right? I mean, these are two of the most incredible psukim in all of Tanakh. So, a couple of points are in order here. One is source number 14. Ibn Ezra disagrees with the Midrashic line that we were talking about before, which likewise contributes to my uncertainty. It is inconceivable that Machlon and Kilyov would marry these women before they converted. The support is to her people and to her gods. Ibn Ezra, I just wanted to read this pasuk before even mentioning him. Ibn Ezra doesn't think that Machlon and Kilyov intermarried. He thinks that the Rut and Orpah converted originally. And his basis for this, which you can agree with or disagree with, I don't think it's a compelling proof, are the verses that we just read, the pasuk that we just read in Tetvav, where it says that she returned to her nation and to her gods, meaning up until now, she was with us. She was part of our nation and served our gods because she was living in our family. So according to Ibn Ezra, followed by Radak on these psukim, Rut and Orpah converted originally. And then what happened here is, Orpah decided essentially to renege and to go back to a Moabite world. And Rut insisted on retaining that she meant that originally, the conversion was sincere. That she really wanted to be part of the whole thing and just stayed with the program. And so she's not converting here, but rather she's affirming that she wishes to continue the lifestyle that she's been doing for the last 10 years, yeah?
Because that one point that makes this a little more complicated than it sounded, the whole notion of Kilo Yavomor, Kilo Yavomoravi, Bikaro Hashem,
right?
Which gets interpreted by the portion saying, well, Moavi, Belo Moavi, all that, but still the comment of Ibn Ezra, and I didn't see the Radak, but sounds a little bit flipped given the severity of the Kilo Yavo Moavi B'Kal Hashem. I mean, she is a Moabiyah, and part of Naomi's hesitation may have come from the fact that she could be bringing back two Moabiyot to Beit Lechem, not just two Nachliyot.
You're raising all excellent points, and in fact, you're setting me up brilliantly for next week. So you're doing a great job. Thank you. And so, yes, this issue is going to come closer to the fore when we discuss possible motives behind why Naomi is doing this. And one of them very well might be the Moabite factor. For the record, from the Department of Moabite Statistics in our Megillah, it's a tiny book. Again, it's only 85 psukim long. Ruth is called the Moabiyah 7 times. You'd think after once or twice we'd sort of get it, right? But the fact that it keeps on coming up might very well be one of the... It's not just a Chazal concern of, wait a minute, what's the halachic status of this marriage? The answer is what you said. She's a woman, so she can get in there. But all the same, it's clearly a pshat-related issue where her Moabite-ness matters. It's not just something that's bothering Chazal, it's something that's bothering our author. And that's something that we have to pick up again next time. But before we get to next time, we still have this time. You don't want to lose this. You do a lot in 5 minutes, you'll see. So source number 15. So I just wanted to point out that there is debate over whether or not they converted originally, nor is, as we've seen, is it clear that Machlon and Kilion died for this reason anyway. What matters more is Orpah's midrashic character that comes into play now. Chazal darshin her name in source number 15. The shame of the one was Orpah because she turned her back, which, you know, the back of her neck is an oref, on her mother-in-law. For the record, it's the same question that we had with Machlon and Kilion, but not as dramatic. Orpah might be a Moabite name, in which case there's no... It doesn't mean that, right? It might very well be that her mom and dad named her Orpah, and it's a good Moabite name. There's some Semitic root which comes close to Orpah, which means cloud. Okay, so maybe she was born on a cloudy day. And so the parents looked out the window, desperately thinking of what they should name her, and they, oh, you know, the sign came from heaven, so they named her Cloudy. Fine. And in which case, Chazal are darshening the name based on what she does in the story, namely to turn around and go back. But clearly there's a midrashic negative sentiment to her. And this brings us to source number 16, which I mentioned before, or Rabbi Winter was talking about. They fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants, as it is written. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. We might say something more like cleaved, but okay, I like the word clave. Rabbi Isaac said, the Holy One, blessed be He, spake. May the sons of the one who kissed come and fall by the hand of the sons of the one who clave. Okay, in plain English. Sometimes translations make it harder, right? But in the meantime, in plain English, what this Gemara is saying is picking up on that midrashic tradition of, well, in Pshat, David is the great-grandson of Ruth. And in Drash, Goliath becomes the great-grandson of Orpah. And so the point is that the one who kissed the mother-in-law, namely Orpah, well, her children should fall to the hands of the ones who clung, namely the descendants of Ruth. Very nice. It's a beautiful thing. When I took geometry in, like, whatever it was, ninth grade, okay, so that was the first time I found math hard. I used to be good at math, and then ninth grade came along, and wasn't so good at math anymore. One thing that really irked me, if I had a board, I would draw a 1-degree angle to the best of my ability. It probably would be more like a 27-degree angle, because I can't make it that small, but okay. Let's picture a right angle, okay? So the teacher would write a nice, cute little L on the board and say, this is a 90-degree angle. Okay, if that's what the teacher says, you write that in the notebook, it's a 90-degree angle, I'm good. But then, here was the tricky part. She pointed out that if you keep drawing these lines, right, it's still a 90-degree angle. And I said, well, that can't be, because that L is much bigger than the other L. Right? How could you say that the angles are the same? They're not. This one is gigantic. And then what was worse is if you drew a great big alligator one that was a 4-degree angle, and then you had this cute little L that was a 90-degree angle, somehow the big alligator was a smaller angle than that little L. This is when you knew that the teacher was a liar, right? Because you could see with your own eyes that the alligator is bigger than the little L. I was having a really hard time, okay? So after a while, I figured out how this really worked, but it took a while. But eventually, I caught on to the concept of what she was doing. But I think that Chazal are actually brilliantly hitting on this angle thing once you understand how the angles on the board work, right? Like, the idea is if you have a 1-degree angle, okay, so at the beginning, the points between the two lines are it's very tiny. What's the big difference? Orpah and Ruth are both lovely people. But sometimes you make a decision. You're at a crossroads. You might not even realize how big of a decision it is. This was a crossroads decision that these two women made. And what Chazal are saying is that as the paths continue, it's the same 1-degree angle, but they grow farther and farther apart. So Orpah chose to stay. Why? To get a shidduch. But of course, well, staying in Moab means that you're retaining or resuming a pagan lifestyle. And what do you think is going to happen to your great-grandchildren? You're going to get a Goliath. You're going to get somebody who's really bad. I think Chazal are very much hitting on this point, that they see this crossroads scene here where Orpah is a very sympathetic character. She's not a bad person. But they understand that the consequence of her remaining in a pagan land, whereas Ruth chose very forcefully to go back to monotheism, that changed the world for their family lines. I think there's something very powerful about what Chazal are doing. And this hits upon something which is really amazing. In source number 17, and this is how we're going to wrap it up for tonight. Now, it's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot that there are four types of character in men. He that says, mine is mine, thine is thine. This is a neutral type. One of the four types is somebody who says, what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours. So one opinion is, okay, that's just a regular person. You're not spectacular, but you're not bad. Some say this is a Sodom type of character. If you're so hands-off as to say, what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours, oh, I'm not harming the other person, that's what Sodom did too. They were anti-hospitality, right? They didn't take care of anybody. This is what happened. Orpah is kind of like this. Right? Orpah is just saying, look, I have to take care of myself. I can't worry anymore about chesed. And don't forget, somewhere in the backdrop of all the story, where did Moab come from? They're from Sodom, right? These are Lot's, well, children, funny enough, children and grandchildren, right? Because of that wacky story over there. But in the meantime, this passage in Pirkei Avot, I think, very well picks up on the theme in Megillat Ruth, which is that the normal characters are normal by just looking out for their own interests against chesed. That simultaneously is what sets them back, is just they fade from history, and the really great people are coming up beginning next week. On that happy note, 60 minutes, we are done, and we will therefore call it here. But I want to thank you all again for coming, and my grandmother's... May my grandmother's memory be for a blessing. Thank Rabbi Hochberg. Thank you again to all the sponsors and to John for putting it all together. I look forward to seeing you next week.